This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Center for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Hi, so I'm here today with Dr. Adam Amara from ETH in Zurich. Welcome to the Jodcast.
Hi, it's very nice to be here.
Glad to have you here, your first time, I
believe. Yes.
So we just had a great talk from you about your research in cosmology. Could you start off by telling our listeners a little bit about what you're interested in?
Okay, so what I study is cosmology. So just in case people don't know, that's the study of the universe, how it got to where it is today and what it looks like. So on very large scales, as we look out at the sky. Cosmology, of course, is a very old discipline. Wondering about our place in the universe is a very old discipline. I think in the 20th century it became a solid science, and now we have made a lot of measurements, and we know surprisingly an awful lot about the universe. We know how old it is, we know how big it is, we know how many galaxies we expect to see. And so I work generally in this area, and the reason I like it is because when we have looked out at the universe, because we think we understand physics, we look at the lab, we think we understand physics. It turns out, though, when we did look out and make these very high-precision measurements, we found a lot of surprises. We found that the universe was full of this weird stuff called dark matter. We've never seen that anywhere else. We found that the universe, which should have started in a, let's say, a great big fireball and just been slowing down, the universe is getting faster and faster and faster. It's just weird. It makes no sense. There's nowhere in physics that we see this thing. So there's a lot of mysteries in fundamental physics and our fundamental understanding of nature that have come up in cosmology. So I like to study these things. And it turns out to do that, you need to build big experiments, which is also very exciting. And you work with smart people from all over the world. And you've got to try really hard to measure very small features. And hopefully, if we try hard enough, we might find something new.
Ah, okay. So one of the things I liked in your talk was you were talking about how in cosmology in the future, you almost need a holistic approach, in that you can't just take individual probes, whether it's the cosmic microwave background, so the light from the really early universe or weak lensing, you can't just take them individually, do your analysis and then compare them. You need to look at them right at the early stages. So what kind of brought you round to that idea, and what have you been doing with it?
Well, first of all, I like, the the original title of my talk was Holistic View of the Cosmos.
Oh, nice.
Well done. Yeah. No, so I think that's right. In the past, we were making these discoveries by looking one place at a time. You look over here, wow, something weird came up. You look over here, something else interesting came up. Now, what we've done in the last 10 or 20 years is I think we've pushed that to the limit, and we sort of, at some level, understand how the pieces fit together. And with anything, the more you learn, if you want to push it, now you have to, does the evidence from this part work together with the evidence from somewhere else? So, if something, let's say the cosmic microwave wants something to be big, but the supernova wants something to be low, well, it's that difference between them that can really give us clues as to what might be happening. And so, indeed, I think the future of cosmology is to become kind of all-rounders and take this holistic view. What's nice in cosmology is that the physics is reasonably straightforward, and we can predict all the things that we should see in one shot. And so let's see in one go that all the things fit. We'll make a prediction, and let's see that everything fits together in one go. And it's important because, for instance, a lot of the contamination, any measurement, you're contaminated by something they have to deal with. And a lot of them have the same stuff. To get to the universe, you have to go through our galaxy. And it's the same galaxy. So if somebody does a correction for our galaxy, takes away the effect of the light from our galaxy, and somebody else over here does a different correction, well, now we're going to get a problem. So we should make sure that we do our corrections in consistent ways. So indeed, I think for the measurements themselves, for the predictions, and then all of the nitty-gritty measurement stuff, we need to do that in one shot.
No, I think that makes sense, and I can definitely see that when you're trying to compare different works and use different ways to, remove the galaxy or correct for the galaxy, it becomes a nightmare to compare the two.
Right.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. So one thing you said that I'm going to jump on is that you said that, the physics is relatively simple. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about that, because I think to your average person who's not a cosmologist, you kind of think, well, how could it be simple? So what do you mean?
All right, okay, so it's simple in that first you've got to learn general relativity. So once you've got general relativity under your belt, and you're comfortable with that, and various other mathematical tricks like perturbation theory, once you've got these things under your belt, It turns out that you can describe the universe in a very small number of numbers. So the equations that flow from general relativity, which is our description of gravity that Einstein came up with 100 years ago, the equations that flow from that, if you just say, I'm going to assume that this thing that was tested on Earth and around the Earth, I'm going to assume that this works for the whole universe, and I'm just going to see what happens. If you go ahead and do that, it turns out that's what things look like, generally. And there's not a lot of wiggle room if you decide that GR is correct and you work with perturbations. So that's what I mean. It's straightforward if you can do the math. Yep. But there's not a lot of wiggle room.
I think that makes sense. So you are more involved on kind of the lensing side of cosmology, is that right? So what kind of work are you involved with there?
So again, lensing was one of these things that was basically discovered, invented, because of Einstein's gravity. So until then, we had Newton, right? Newton had two masses can pull each other and that they have gravity between them. And we've all done that in school, gm over r squared. But with Einstein, he said, okay, we have to replace that. And what happens is mass bends space-time and then things move around in a bent space-time. And since light is a thing, that also has to go around a space-time. And it was a very clear prediction that could have easily been wrong. And, you know, he made a number of predictions. So this one about light bending around mass was something that was tested in Edison's eclipse experiment. Pretty much straight away, you look at where stars are behind the sun during an eclipse, and you look at where stars are when the sun's not there. And if Einstein's relativity is right, stars should move because of the mass of the sun. And if Newton is right, the stars should stay exactly where they are. And you know what? The stars moved in exactly the way predicted by general relativity. That was like the first success of lensing. So this was about, what was it, 1919, roughly? That
something like that. It was around 100 years ago.
Yeah. And then, so the sun is very close to us and it's very massive. So then people thought about, okay, well, what's the next star? Maybe that. They decided that it wasn't feasible for that thing to lens. There's a long gap. Nothing happened in lensing, like, for close to 40 years.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, nothing happened. And then this eccentric, interesting astronomer, this Swiss astronomer, Zwicky, who's at Caltech, wrote an interesting paper. Like, instead of thinking about individual stars, you should think about collections of stars in a nebula, and maybe they'd be enough together to bend light. Okay, so that's interesting. So we're in, what is it, the 1940s? Still, between 1919, it took till 1979 to have the next measurement of lensing. But the weird thing is, so what it meant is the telescopes got better, the detectors got better, everything got better, our measurements got better. From that moment on, like, it's accelerated, so now we can't stop measuring lensing. In fact, astronomers who don't care about lensing complain that all their stuff gets lensed. You know, it's the weirdest thing.
It happens to everything.
Right, so if it happens to everything, I'm a big fan and I like to measure it. And what I like about it is, again, it comes directly from a very clean theory, general relativity. So if you can figure out how much the light was bent, you know exactly how much mass there was. And it doesn't matter what the mass is, whether it's hydrogen, helium, or dark matter, or blue matter, pink matter, you know, invent any kind of matter you want, it'll be the same. And that I like.
Yeah, simple in that respect.
Simple in that, hard to measure, but now we know how to do it.
Actually, so that reminds me, when you were introduced before the talk, it was mentioned that you discovered a protoplanet?
Yeah.
How did you get from cosmology to a protoplanet?
Oh, that was sort of a hobby, yeah. Okay. Well, what happens is, again, as I said, lensing, the physics is simple, but the measurement is really hard. And in particular, the way that the telescope distorts the light itself can mimic the lensing effect. So it's something that we call the point spread function. So you want to handle that very well in lensing. You want to understand how the telescope messes with the light. Okay, if you look at planets, you have a star, and you have a planet that goes around the star. It's a really simple system. You know, physics is really easy. Really hard to measure, because the star and the planet are very close together. So if you take a picture, all you see is the star, distorted by the telescope, in exactly the same way as in lensing. It has a point spread function. And then there's a tiny little planet that's obscure. So what happened is, myself and a friend of mine in Zurich, his name's Sascha Kuntz, who works on planets, were having coffee one day, and he told me about the algorithms they have for detecting planets. Because I'm so obsessed about correcting for telescopes, I thought I could do a better job. You know, scientists like to trash talk each other. He thought I couldn't. And so I went and I wrote an algorithm, and then he challenged me, he gave me some data, and I processed it, and this blob came out.
Wow.
And the blob turned out to be a planet, HD 100546b.
That's very cool.
Yeah, a baby plant. He gave me a bit of a hard time.
Yeah, I was gonna say I'm sure he wouldn't have responded that well.
Well, his words were no way, nobody finds a planet on their first go. And so then I tried to get rid of it. I was like, oh, I must have made a mistake. I tried to get rid of it. It stayed. We published. Then we went to the telescope, the VLT, which is a very big telescope in Chile. It's a very exciting trip for me because sometimes I'm more of a theorist. But we had two nights of observing, and then in the first night, I analyzed the data as we went, and indeed, it was still there. It was real.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and then you can do little tests to make sure it's moved in the right way, and it all moved in the right way. So it's a real planet, and yeah.
Wow. And that technique the algorithm that you used, is that something that is now used in that area of research?
Yeah, so I made the thing public. So it's something called principal component analysis to direct imaging. And indeed, I think that's the current methods are all sort of based around that. So at the same time that I came up with this algorithm, another group did as well, so similar, where the field was going at the time.
That's pretty cool anyway. And that's, I like those examples where, you know, you're actually facing a similar problem in two different fields, and so you manage to use them across both. That's very cool. So you're also, I believe, one of the founding members of Euclid, which is an upcoming weak lensing survey.
Yep.
Could you tell me a little bit more about why you're interested in Euclid and what we should expect from it?
Well, I think Euclid, there's a whole array, actually. There's LSST is a big ground-based experiment. There's Euclid, this European space-based project, and there's also WFIRST, this big, NASA space-based project. So I think together these three are going to be very exciting. I started on Euclid back in 2005. Back then we called it DUNE. It was a very small team. Most of the work was done by two scientists, myself and Alex Refrigier, and we worked with a French space agency. You know, the people that did the work, about five or six people, but it was a really fun time because we were defining an entire space mission. So, you know, whatever needed to be done, you would do. If somebody needed to do, figure out how to get the data from the satellite down, telemetry, well, you would go, you'd Google, you'd try and learn this topic of telemetry and design a thing around that. So it was a very exciting time, and then the mission got big, so we decided to move it onto a European scale, so we submitted this proposal to ESA, and the team got bigger. I think 75 missions competed, and we came in the top few, so the top few got selected. The team grew, we were merged with another mission, and then we became Euclid, and then we refined the design, and it's a very interesting process to go through, because I don't know, you've met a lot of scientists, they're very good thinkers, sort of creative thinkers. It's sometimes hard to pin them down on specifics.
Yes.
Okay. Turns out space engineers only care about the specifics.
Oh, okay.
Like, they want to know precisely, okay, in fact, they don't even, you can't say the pixel should be 0.2 microns. Like, no, that's impossible. I want the range. It should be between what and what. And so they're very precise people. Now, that interface between the wish list that the scientists have and the precise thing that the space engineers know they can build, well, that's a very difficult interface to manage, and that's mostly where I sat. It involved a bit of diplomacy between the two, but it's a very interesting thing, and then finally we fleshed out the mission. It got funding, and it should be due to launch 2020 middle. Yeah, so I think that's going to be a big breakthrough. That, especially combined with the others, is going to be a big breakthrough for the next generation of very high-quality measurements of the sky.
Oh, that is really exciting. And I think you're right in that we are in that kind of golden point for cosmology. We're hopefully going to see, you know, all these new surveys come in, which is going to be pretty exciting.
Yeah, I think so. It's the CMB has already gone through this.
Yeah.
And so we're about, I think, to do this with the low redshift universe. The universe between us and about two-thirds of the history of the universe, that bit of the universe, we're about to go through, I think, a golden age.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think are the main challenges facing your field at the moment? And so what do you see as being the big barriers you need to overcome before you're able to deal with that wealth of information?
Well, I think it's just handling the data. And it's such a new regime of data volumes that I think one of the things at least in my own personal opinion, one of the things we have to come to terms with is the old methods no longer apply. And we have to invent new ways of handling and representing and processing the data. The CMB had to do this. So the cosmic microwave background, the nice thing about it is so it's a universe very far away, but it's a kind of like a 2D snapshot of the universe. So they invented lots of ways of analyzing data in 2D, on a 2D sphere. What we have to do now is work in 3D, a full 3D, what we call ball geometry. And there are just things that we have to learn how to deal with. And so I think it's more inventing new methods for processing the data volumes are large, checking that we're doing things cleanly. That's going to be, I think, the big challenge. But at least designing the instruments and the hardware, I think we've overcome those. We know how
you
to build these
experiments.
Yeah. Those are done. Mm-hmm. But what do we do when we actually have the data in hand? I think there's a lot more to be invented.
Okay, well, that's interesting to know. So anyway, thank you for coming on the Jobcast. Hopefully we'll have you on again in the future.